Welcome to Ag in Uncertain Times, a series of webinar presentations intended to assist agricultural professionals, extension educators, and practitioners prepare for the challenges developing in agriculture today. This week, we're offering our last two webinars on families facing uncertainty. I'm John Hewlett, a ranch and farm management specialist here at the University of Wyoming. I will serve as your host for the webinars this week, but I do so only through the help and assistance of many others working behind the scenes to make these presentations possible. Our team members come from a number of Western states, and without their support and the support of the institutions they work for, these webinars just simply would not be possible. Again, the intent of Ag in Uncertain Times is to help folks involved in agriculture meet the challenges of the current times. You might be doing that by viewing these live presentations or accessing the recordings that we've been making of each and every one of our past webinars, or accessing the recordings to help make presentations to other audiences with which you work in a somewhat of a rebroadcast of the material. In today's webinar, we'll be exploring both business and personal bankruptcy, and especially chapters 11 and 12 of the Bankruptcy Code. Although bankruptcy is a choice few agricultural managers would consider without being forced into it, this option may be needed by some to appropriately adjust to the changing economics we are currently facing. We have two speakers today who will be discussing the details of bankruptcy via a formal slide presentation. We'll follow that up with a chance for questions from our audience for one or both of the presenters. Today's presenters will include Norm Dahlstedt, a farm management specialist and professor at Colorado State University, and Ken Koppel, an attorney practicing in Fort Collins, Colorado, who has extensive experience in bankruptcy cases. We'll provide a little more in-depth introduction to each of these gentlemen as we begin the program, but first I have a couple of other introductory comments to go through. First, let me explain how the participants in the webinar can put questions to our speakers. The process we'll follow is that you type any question you might have into the chat window at the lower left of your screen. Those questions will be taken in by the team that's working behind the scenes and compiled into common questions or rephrased so they sound a little better perhaps, and they will put those to me, who will then put them to the speakers during our question and answer period. We'd also encourage you that if you're experiencing any technical difficulties in participating in the webinar, whether audio or some other issue, that you might let us know through that chat window as well. One of our team members will get back to you to try to address any technical problems you might be experiencing today. Today's webinar is the 11th in our series since beginning in June, when we focused on uncertain credit. In September, we offered several programs looking at uncertain markets. And this month, October, we are looking more closely at families facing uncertainty in agriculture. All of our past programs are available as video downloads or as audio MP3 files, and you may access those in several different ways at our website, Ag in Uncertain Times. We invite you to visit that site later if you're interested in access those recordings or other materials following today's presentation. Where are we going from here? Tomorrow we will have another program, excellent presentation by Ruth Hambleton and Dr. Robert Fetch, who will each provide insights on various tools and techniques currently available to farm families to help meet the challenges ahead. In November, we will have or planning a series of presentations looking at risk management and how managers might get started planning today and managing for the risks in the coming production cycle. Another effort currently underway, an extension across the U.S., which we'd like to draw your attention to, is called Managing in Tough Times. A website has been developed to house materials and information for extension professionals and others in helping agricultural producers address the challenges in today's economy. We encourage you to take a look at this impressive set of information found at mitnet.extension.org. Finally, before we begin today's program, we would like to point out that if you are having trouble viewing the on-screen slide material, you may click on the full screen button to toggle the slides to fill the entire screen on your machine. Clicking it again will reveal the chat window and slide materials in a side-by-side format. We'll move now to our speakers, and we're very fortunate today to actually have both of these gentlemen with us. They have both got a great deal of experience in helping farm families in bankruptcy workouts, and so I'm very gratified that they were able to join us. They're planning somewhat of a tag team approach for today's program, so I'm going to introduce both of them up front here and let them kind of take it from there. I'd like to start with Norm Dahlstead, who is a professor and farm management specialist at Colorado State University. His primary area of research include costs of production related to crops, vegetable, fruit, and livestock throughout the state of Colorado. Norm also does a great deal of work with crop insurance across the state and in programs with Kansas, Nebraska, Wyoming, and several other states. Two other major areas of interest cover estate planning and financial analysis in the context of bankruptcy, particularly Chapter 11 and Chapter 12 reorganizations. Norm has worked extensively with farm families across Colorado and around the region to develop the necessary documentation to complete the bankruptcy process. I have known Norm for over two decades and can attest to the fact that he is without a doubt one of the country's experts when it comes to agricultural bankruptcy. Further, Norm has many ties to production agriculture. In fact, he spends many weeks each harvest season in the cab of a combine as part of a custom harvest crew. He truly understands the issues faced by today's farm families. I'll move now to introduce Ken. Ken and Norm, as I understand it, basically work somewhat as a tag team when they're offering farm family bankruptcy programs when they present. So today's program will not be unusual for them. Ken is a practicing attorney located in Fort Collins, Colorado, with Ken Koppel and Associates. He represents ranchers, dairies, family farms in all areas of agricultural law, including water disputes, agribusiness litigation, and bankruptcy reorganization. Ken has been representing clients in Chapter 11 and 12 bankruptcies for more than 20 years. He is also a frequent guest lecturer at Colorado State University in the areas of agricultural law and has in the past taught classes in water law and agricultural law at CSU. More information is available on both of these speakers at our Ag and Uncertain Times website. The presentation they prepared for today's webinar is entitled, Is Bankruptcy a Viable Option for Financially Distressed Agricultural Producers? So without further delay, I'll turn it to them to get started. I believe Ken plans to lead off, and let me say again, thank you both for your willingness to join us today in this presentation.
Okay, thank you. My name is Ken Koppel, and I'm going to talk about agricultural bankruptcy and some related issues this morning. Agricultural bankruptcy is designed to help family farms, dairies, ranches, all types of production agriculture to restructure their debts so that they can continue with their operation. Agricultural bankruptcy can fall under either Chapter 11 or Chapter 12. Chapter 12 is a chapter that is designed specifically for agriculture. Chapter 11 is not designed specifically for agriculture. It, you know, Frontier Airlines has filed Chapter 11. We've heard about GM has filed Chapter 11. Sometimes it is used in farm and ranch operations, but Chapter 12 is the preferred chapter for farm and ranch situations. So the most of what I'll be talking about this morning will be related to the Chapter 12. Let's start out. I'd like to talk about several things that trigger a bankruptcy filing. Probably the most common trigger is either a foreclosure or a replevin action. A foreclosure is where a lender seeks to take back the real estate. So if you have a loan with a farm credit and they foreclose on your farm, they're seeking to take back your real estate. They're not seeking to take back your cattle or your tractors or your equipment. The legal action that seeks to take back your cattle and equipment is called a replevin action. Some people refer to that as repossession. The legal term is replevin. The replevin action is a much quicker legal proceeding. The bank can file the replevin action today, and they may have a court hearing 10 days from now. Whereas the foreclosure action is a slower proceeding. You have more time in the event of the foreclosure. So these are two things that we, over the years, that I have seen that trigger people to come in and want to know about Chapter 12. You're served with legal papers. You know, it's obviously a very stressful time for the family farmer, and they don't know what to do, so they come and see an agricultural attorney. The only problem with that is that we often don't have a lot of time under those circumstances to take action. There's some deadlines in the foreclosures and replevins. So I think it is wise for producers to look at the Chapter 12 before you get to that point. Now, just because a foreclosure or a replevin is filed, that doesn't mean that you can't then file Chapter 12, but you're going to be in a time crunch if you wait that long. So let's look and see at what some of the other chapters are on the introduction page that are available under the code, just to go over the chapters. Chapter 7 is the liquidation chapter. There's no reorganization plan in Chapter 7. All you're doing is liquidating your assets. So in a farm situation, you're going to sell your land. You're going to usually auction the equipment and the cattle. In the Chapter 7, when the proceeding is done, all that you have left are usually things like your household furnishings and things that are exempt under the bankruptcy law. In Chapter 7, you don't continue with your farming business. Chapter 11, I spoke about a little bit. It's a reorganization. It's a broad chapter. It's designed for corporations and individuals, all the way from Frontier Airlines down to a mom-and-pop grocery store. As long as you're trying to reorganize some sort of a business, you're going to be eligible for Chapter 11. Chapter 12, obviously, is the chapter we're going to focus on, and that's the agricultural chapter. Chapter 13 is a reorganization for a wage earner. This would be someone, for example, that works at a job and gets a paycheck every 2 weeks or every month, and they want to, usually it involves a situation where they want to retain their house, they want to restructure the loans on their house. Very rarely is Chapter 13 applicable to a farm or ranch situation. Let's see what's on the next. Yeah, Chapter 12 is designed for the family farmers and ranchers. This can include dairies, this can include feedlots, this can include all types of farming and ranching. There are eligibility requirements to be in Chapter 12. The probably the most common eligibility issue is the total debt. The total debt must not exceed $3.237 million. I've met recently with some clients and potential clients, and they're over significantly over that debt limit. If you're over that limit, then your option is Chapter 11, but you're not going to be eligible for Chapter 12. The other eligibility requirements don't come up as often. They are examined at the time that you file, and this is something that that the agricultural lawyer or the consultant or the farm and ranch manager needs to look into when discussing this with farm and ranch families. Are these eligibility requirements? There are different requirements for the individual and the corporation. The debt limit is the same, but with the corporation, 80% of the assets, the value of assets, must be related to the agricultural business. So we do have these eligibility requirements, and that's a threshold issue that must be examined before you really before you go any further in your discussion of the bankruptcy. Now, just because you're not eligible for Chapter 12, that does not mean that you're out of luck. You can still file Chapter 11. Again, Chapter 12 is preferred and works better as a general rule for farm and ranch families. Well, let's see. Other eligibility issues, which would be on the next screen, I believe, are prior bankruptcies and credit counseling. If you have a prior bankruptcy, you need to inform your attorney of that or your farm and ranch management person so they can see if that is going to cause a problem with filing a new bankruptcy. Also, all debtors and borrowers must do credit counseling within 180 days before filing a case. That can be done online, and it's really a kind of a formality, but it is something that needs to be done. So let's also talk about other issues that we want to look at, and let me talk first about a little bit about the time frame on Chapter 12. Because Chapter 12, for a legal proceeding, it is a fairly quick-moving process. If you file a Chapter 12 case today, your plan of reorganization will come due in 90 days. During that 90 days, you're going to have several meetings with the creditors, with your trustee, and with your attorney, and so there's going to be a lot happening in that 90-day period. So you have a fairly short time to prepare your reorganization plan. Approximately 40 days after you file your plan, you're going to have your initial hearing with the judge to determine what objections have been filed to your plan. And then sometime after that, and this time frame is kind of an approximation, but say 160 to 180 days after you file, you're going to have your final confirmation hearing, which is, you would think of that like a trial with a judge. There's no jury, but you testify before the judge on your Chapter 12 plan proceeding. So because of these time frames, and because the 90 days goes by pretty quick, there are things that we need to look at before filing. These are things that Norm and I look at in these cases before we even file the case, and these are things that farm and ranch managers and producers themselves can look at and think about before deciding to file the Chapter 12. So I'm going to go through some things. I don't think these things are not going to be on the screen, but these are important factors that we need to look at. One would be what loans would you be restructuring? Would you restructure the loan on your real estate? Would you restructure the loan on your equipment? Are you current on either any of your loans? Because if you're current on loans, you can just stay current and not restructure those loans in the Chapter 12 case. Another issue is cash flow. Will your farm cash flow after you reorganize? This is very important because oftentimes creditors bring up this issue as an objection to confirmation. In other words, the bank will say, "Judge, we just don't think this will work. We don't think it'll cash flow because the producer is not using realistic numbers." So if for example, you're an alfalfa producer and your cash flow, you're showing that you're gonna sell alfalfa for $300 a ton, you're not gonna get away with that. So you have to use realistic numbers, and those realistic numbers have to show that it will cash flow. By cash flow, we mean you'll be able to make your new payments to the lenders. You'll be able to make payments to your suppliers and the co-op and those types of creditors. And you'll be able to continue on with your operation for a period of at least 3 years. We'll need we need a three-year cash flow, and that's what Norm Dahlstedt does in these cases, is prepare these cash flow documents. So that's a very important consideration, and you can look at that before you file the case. You may not have a precise cash flow as far as knowing how everything is going to turn out, but if you meet with your attorney and your farm consultant, you can kind of rough out a cash flow and you have a pretty good idea going in whether or not it's going to work financially. I would say that is one of the two biggest issues that we need to examine prior to filing the case. The second big issue, the second of the big issues, is operating credit. We see an awful lot of producers that are interested in Chapter 12, but they do not have operating credit. And this is obviously can be a problem. If you don't have operating credit and you file Chapter 12, you're not going to be getting into the case very long before the judge or the trustee is going to raise this issue. How are you going to operate if you don't have an operating loan? So that can be a problem. Some producers have operating loans that they've got lined up before they file the Chapter 12. Some producers have cash flow that is not encumbered by any of their liens. For example, a farm operation that does a lot of custom work, that custom work is income is generally not encumbered by any bank lien, so you can operate off your custom work. The dairies, they have cash flow with their milk income. The milk income generally is encumbered with liens, but we can, in those cases, go to the judge and ask the judge to let us use a portion of that milk income to maintain the cattle and continue the operations at least for the 90-day period of time so that we can determine if we can reorganize. So the cash flow and the operating funds, I think those are the two, really the two things that need to be focused on before we file the case, as well as eligibility. So let's see here what we have on the next, I think the next sheet that's on the screen now, economic feasibility. Norm, do you want to address that?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and address that, Ken. Obviously, the first point is that we need to address, and that Ken has kind of mentioned this briefly, is that is there a possibility that the reorganization is a feasible way to pursue the future with? And of course, he's addressed the payments. One thing I think that's important for producers to realize is that an appraisal will be necessary, and based on the appraised value of the assets, that's the amount that the loans will be re-amortized, etc., based on the appraised value. So in the case, for example, of one dairy that I recently worked with, they had nearly $900,000 in debt, but the appraised value of the assets were $300,000. So basically the $300,000 is what they're going to repay. So it did give them a fair amount of latitude in terms of their payments. Of course, the amount that they're short in terms of the appraised value then goes into what's called the unsecured, because you're going to have both secured creditors and unsecured creditors. And then Ken will talk about liquidation analysis later on here when he gets into the tax consequences as well. Obviously, one thing that I try to point out to producers is that what you've done in the past, if that's not working, proposing the same plan for the future is probably not going to be accepted by either the bankruptcy judge or the creditors. So we need to look at, and this is where a farm management specialist or a business analysis would serve a very valuable role in determining what can we do that could better our operation. And one of the key things that Ken and I have found is by working with them in terms of their marketing, improving their marketing skills. Sometimes just a simple forward contracting of commodities. So the judge can see that there's going to be guaranteed income from whatever products you're producing on your farm or ranch. That certainly will assist in making the decision. So that aspect's important. Irregardless of what you think the markets are going to do, whatever, it also enhances your cash flow ability, et cetera. The other thing is to look at crop insurance as collateral in terms of meeting your future needs, certainly carrying adequate crop insurance on those insurable crops and range grounds and pasture grounds, et cetera, also our way of handling that. Agricultural options, puts or calls, also will provide some reasonable reduction in risk in terms of uncertainty related to prices in the future. So those things are, those minor things, even though they seem minor, are fairly important, particularly when we get into cash collateral. As Ken pointed out, that one of the key problems that I have seen in recent years is the ability of the operations to cash flow. Because in case of a cow-calf operation, we have income once or twice a year. So we need to have monies to cover our operating costs and our family living, which is also a very important aspect during those periods of time where we have very little income or not income at all. So we need to make sure that we have some cash surpluses to cover that. And that gets to be a very difficult hurdle to overcome in some cases. In those cases, unless we can find a secondary lender or an outside lender to provide us with cash our operating costs, we're going to be in difficulty. Some cases, family members will offer to help, but nevertheless, we have to make sure that they are repaid as well. One other thing that I think is important is that you, and this has been an issue, I think, in most states, is to find a qualified agribusiness consultant, a farm management specialist or whatever, to work with individual farms in ranches to go through this process. Ken and I have been doing this for Chapter 12 since 1986, I believe. So we're getting close to 25 years, so needless to say, we've had a fair amount of experience. But finding someone locally to prepare the plan that can be qualified as an expert in the federal bankruptcy court is incredibly important, in my opinion. You need to bring someone with credibility related to market prices, etc. And along those lines, one other thing that I recommend that business consultants do is that they actually develop, and for those of us that have had training in farm management in our lifetime, develop a crop and livestock plan over the life of the reorganization plan. So you would identify the crops, the yields, the expected prices, and obviously the revenue that's going to be associated with that, and you need to document that. You can do that by looking at historical information related to that particular crop on that farm. If that information is not available, certainly you would have average yields prices by county through the National Agricultural Statistical Service or through the your local Department of Ag in each state, or possibly through your land grant institution. Certainly they will have enterprise budgets that you can use as a foundation to develop that. You would do the same thing with the livestock. Basically, how many cows you're going to have or how many ewes you're going to have or hogs, etc. And what is the livestock plan in terms of production and prices, replacement rates, retention rates, and so on in terms of females. All that kind of information is, in my opinion, is extremely important in terms of providing that kind of information to the bankruptcy court and or the creditors as well. And that should be done for at least 3 years. Most Chapter 12s that I have been involved in have usually had a 3-year time frame to them. There are a few cases where you may have, because of the debt servicing and maybe the amount of unsecured credit that lies out there, that you may have to do a 5-year plan. But in most cases, 3 years will cover that quite adequately. Just some other little minor points. One thing that I think is probably as incredibly important as anything is to find a good bankruptcy attorney. Ken, in my opinion, is the best in the state of Colorado, and he has an extensive agricultural background, having grown up and raised on a farm in Nebraska, and currently his son and he are currently running a irrigated corn operation and cattle operation in western Nebraska. So Ken is much in tune with the various agricultural entities that that we have to deal with on a daily basis in Colorado and of course Nebraska and Wyoming. So that's important. Ken is an excellent arbitrator and mediation in terms of trying to get things resolved before we end up in a full-blown trial, trying to get our plan approved. I think if all the details can be worked out and the creditors can be reasonably assured that this plan is going to work, then in those cases, I think that the success rate is extremely high. So having a good bankruptcy attorney in your area, if there's one available, by all means, you need to work with that individual. And I think there are attorneys out there that specialize in bankruptcy and financial mediation, and those are the types of individuals you need to try and identify in your region. So that's a really key point that I wanted to make with you. The other thing is, within your bankruptcy plan, sometimes people don't realize this, but you're going to have to pay trustee fees. So if, like Ken was mentioning, if you have notes that are current and you've made the payments on it, you're not going to pay trustee fees on those. But the notes that are restructured, re-amortized, etc., in Colorado currently the trustee is getting 5%. Now the payments are made directly from the farm to the trustee. Okay, the trustee is not involved in the day-to-day operation. Like you might see in a Chapter 11, where the federal bankruptcy trustee is involved in a more direct way in a Chapter 11. In a Chapter 12, basically he becomes the clearinghouse. All the payments are made to him, along with whatever the fee is. Currently, I believe it's 5%, or at least the last few bankruptcies I've worked on, the fee has been 5%. And then he will distribute the funds, certainly to the secured creditors, as well as those that are in the unsecured pile. Okay. The other thing is that a bankruptcy is going to cost you some money, so you need to make sure that you have some adequate funds to retain a bankruptcy attorney. Okay, and you may have to account for paying off those legal fees in your reorganization plan as well. One thing that I found that some families try to do, and it doesn't work very well in my opinion, is that we need to be aside from being realistic with our revenues, we certainly don't, as Ken was mentioning, we don't want to overstate those. And we certainly don't want to understate expenses, particularly when we're looking at a farming operation, such things as repair bills, fuel, insurance, and other related costs. We need to be realistic. And we also need to factor in many cases, what I do is try to factor in some nominal increase on an annual basis. For example, we know that diesel fuel today is in the farm fuel is in that low $2 range. Who knows, in 2 to 3 years, it could be as high as $4.50 again, as we observed in the summer of 08. So we need to make some allowance for some sort of contingencies to make sure our cash flow is going to work. We certainly aren't going to probably see a dollar farm fuel again, or extremely cheap fertilizer, for example, which is another big expense, and seed, etc. So we need to make a realistic cash flow. The point I wanted to make too, though, is family living. In too many cases, it's been my experience that families tend to underestimate their family living. And for a family of four in the state of Colorado, certainly expenses for family living are quite high, and probably higher than people would want to admit to. But typically, $2,500 to $3,000 a month is something reasonable to put in your cash flow for family living. Because in many cases, you're not making a house payment because that's part of your farm real estate debt. Possibly some of your insurance, your gasoline that you burn in your personal vehicle, etc., may also be included in your fuel costs and or your insurance payments. So the one thing that I've noticed that is extremely high, and most people are already aware of this, and certainly Congress and our current president are addressing this, is the high cost of insurance, health insurance in particular. And that's something families need to look at, particularly if they have young children. They're probably paying a substantial amount on a monthly basis to cover their health needs. So those are some of the key things that I wanted to point out, and I'm going to turn it over to Ken because I think he has a few other things that he wants to visit with the audience with. Ken?
All right, Norm. First thing I'd like to, or the next thing I would like to address is, how is a loan restructured in a Chapter 12? And this is a frequent question that that we're asked when we meet initially with producers. So let's talk about, how is a loan restructured? How does that work in the Chapter 12? And I'm just going to say hypothetically that we have a $500,000 real estate loan. And that's the balance that is due on the loan on the day we file the case. So the bank is owed $500,000. That includes interest and bank fees and the principal and just the whole ball of wax. And let's say that in this hypothetical that we have a recent appraisal that shows that this farm is only worth $400,000. So that what we do in the Chapter 12 plan is we take the $400,000 and we restructure that into a new loan, a new real estate loan. And the loan can be restructured based upon current market terms. So if it's fairly common for a real estate loan to be restructured over 20 years, then we can do that. We can restructure it over 20 years at a current market interest rate and make payments once or twice a year. So that's how we take care of that $400,000. Now remember, the loan balance was $500,000. So we have $100,000 left over. That $100,000 does not disappear, but it is moved from secured to unsecured. That means that we take that $100,000 and we put it into a pool. We call it a pool of unsecured debt. So that $100,000 would go into that pool. If there are debts owed to unsecured creditors, like let's say you have a fuel bill, let's say you have some credit card bills, let's say the producer owes money to the local co-op for fertilizer and seed. All of those unsecured debts go into this pool, and we do a what's called a liquidation analysis, and it's just we look at what would happen if the producer was liquidated under Chapter 7 on the day of the confirmation hearing or during the Chapter 12. In other words, if you had to line everything up and sell that you owned, all your land and cattle and equipment, how much would be left over after the secured notes were paid off? And then we use that as a guideline, and we in the Chapter 12, we have to pay at least that much, usually a little more. So it varies a lot from case to case. Most Chapter 12 cases, the unsecured pool creditors do not receive 100 cents on the dollar. In some cases, they receive perhaps 10 cents on the dollar or 50 cents on the dollar. I have had cases where it was 100 cents on the dollar, but it varies from case to case. So that's the mechanism that that we use and that the judge uses in working out these loans. So if you have a situation where your loans are undersecured, then that's, you know, it's going to be bifurcated in this fashion. Now, if you have a loan where you owe the bank $500,000 and the appraiser comes in and he says, Judge, this land is worth $600,000, then you're not going to be able to bifurcate the loan. You're not going to be able to make that division. You're going to have to just repay. You can restructure the amount that you owe, but you're not going to have any type of a write-down at all. Also, in that situation, you're going to have to pay interest and reasonable expenses, including attorney fees, that the bank incurs. If you are undersecured on this loan, like in my initial example where the $500,000 loan had collateral that was worth $400,000 based on the appraisal, in that situation, you normally are not going to have to pay interest after the day you file the case, nor are you going to have to pay legal expenses for the bank or costs or other expenses. Sometimes the bank will have another appraisal done and they will try to charge the producer for that appraiser, things like that. So that's how we restructure these secured loans. The unsecured loans and the trade credit, that all goes into this pool, which is lumped together and treated in a separate class. Now, one thing that I would like to point out is the tax considerations. Because this is really another thing that the farm and ranch managers, the attorneys, anyone advising the producer should take into consideration before the case is filed, and that is, would there be a tax advantage to filing the Chapter 12 case? And where this comes up is in regard to the sale of assets, because oftentimes the Chapter 12 case will involve a sale of some of the assets in order to reduce the debt load. So say, for example, that you have a farmer that has 1,000 acres of land, and that he decides he's going to sell 300 acres. He's got an offer to sell 300 out of that 1,000, and he decides he's going to sell that 300 acres. He's going to use that money to pay down his debt load, and he thinks that will streamline and make more efficient his operation. If he makes that transaction during the Chapter 12 as opposed to prior to the Chapter 12, there may be significant tax advantages with regard to the capital gains tax on the transaction. That's because the capital gains tax can be classified as an unsecured debt, and it can be shuffled into this pool. So you may have an $80,000 capital gains tax on that transaction. If it's if the tax debt is moved into this unsecured category, that capital gains tax may be cut down significantly. So this can be a big dollar item in cases where the producer is thinking about selling assets or some of the assets at the time of the Chapter 12. So I would say that's another, along with the cash flow. I think I said earlier that the cash flow issue and the operating funds and the eligibility were three big items that we need to look at. But I would add this tax issue would be the fourth big issue that we need to examine before we file the case, and it certainly needs to be addressed and looked at early on in the discussions with the producer.
Okay.
So I don't think we have anything further, and so Norm, do you have anything else that you want to add?
I think I'll just add a couple of comments. One is, again, I think if you have a good attorney, agricultural attorney, who has some experience in the area of bankruptcy, he can make the process quite tenable for you, because he can resolve a lot of the conflicts, and in many cases, the final hearing could be just a formality, because he's resolved all the objections. As Ken had mentioned earlier, that you may get objections to the plan. We need to resolve those, and certainly as a debtor filing a Chapter 12, I need to work with the creditors possibly to liquidate assets or restructure my business, etc., so that everyone is in agreement. And that's very important, I think, to have an attorney that can do that type of thing. So I think we've covered pretty much everything that Ken and I wanted to say. Granted, we've kind of stuffed everything in to about a 45 or 50-minute presentation. There's probably some nuances we've overlooked, but hopefully those will be brought up in terms of the questions that maybe the audience may have for us individually. So, John, we'll turn it over to you to see if we have any questions from the audience.
Well, thank you both very much for an outstanding presentation and introduction to the details of bankruptcy. I'm sure you've answered a number of the questions folks may have come in with, but we also have a number that folks have started sending in here to put to you for further clarification. The first of which is, how do I know, if I'm looking for a competent attorney to help in restructuring or launching into bankruptcy, how do I know I'm talking to a competent attorney when I contact someone to begin the process?
This is Ken. I think that the question I would ask the attorney would be, what experience do you have in agricultural bankruptcy? How many have you recently filed cases similar to mine? Have you achieved confirmation? I mean, any attorney can file a Chapter 12 case. It's easy to file the case. The hard part is getting the plan confirmed, and that is the goal of the producer. I mean, if you're a producer and you hire an attorney and file a case, and it ends up not being confirmed, then you've spent money and resources, and you haven't achieved your goal. So I think the first question would be, what experience do you have in this area of agricultural bankruptcy?
I think that's the first thing that I would do.
If I can just add something, there are a number of attorneys, for example, in the state of Colorado that I've worked with that have filed Chapter 12s, and the vast majority of them have been quite successful. So, you know, contacting possibly a farm management specialist who's worked in the Chapter 12 area may have some names for you to talk to in terms of qualified attorneys.
Okay, good thoughts. I've had another question come in now. I was wondering about how mediation fits into the picture. How does a person or farmer or rancher know whether or not they should try bankruptcy, try mediation, or maybe some other workout solution? What are some of the trade-offs between those different alternatives?
This is Ken. I would say that that if you have, my experience has been that if you have a small number of disputes, like let's say that you're current on your trade debt, you're current on your, say you're current on your payments to John Deere on your equipment, but you're not current and having problems with one lender, you're just having problems with one lender, so it's a fairly isolated situation, that in that case mediation is a good idea. I think it's good that you explore that. In cases where the producer has multiple problems, you're in default and there's a foreclosure filed by the one lender, there's another legal action filed by a second lender, you're behind on your payroll taxes or on some sort of a tax obligation, you're behind on your trade debt, you owe the co-op money, you know, you've got multiple problems, then it's hard to mediate all of those different things. One good thing about Chapter 12 is it takes kind of an overall approach. In other words, the goal of Chapter 12 is that when you're done and you have your plan confirmed, you then have a new, it's like you have a new mortgage with all of your different creditors. The other thing I'd like to point out is that in the Chapter 12 case, if you're unable to mediate out your issues before filing the Chapter 12, in the Chapter 12 case, in almost every situation, the judge is going to encourage the parties to mediate. It doesn't mean you go meet with a mediator, but it's going to encourage you to negotiate and try and iron out your differences. I've had judges tell me on a number of occasions that, I want you attorneys to go and sit down and, you know, just make a good faith effort to try and iron out these differences, and bring me a plan that we can all agree on. Because if you bring the judge a plan that everyone can agree on, then you don't need the confirmation hearing, and it makes things go much more smoothly. So, anyway, I think you, in some cases, mediation before filing is a good idea. I don't think it works when there's just a numerous defaults on all different classes of creditors.
If I can just add a comment to that, too. I think that if most farmers and ranchers or dairymen, whatever, are having financial difficulties, if they're proactive, if they're working with a lender to work out of them, then mediation tends to be a more feasible solution. But if they've let the payment dates come and pass, then of course the lenders have fewer options available or alternatives available to them. So having a good relationship with your lender is incredibly important, because it certainly is going to help you through if you end up filing a Chapter 12, and there may be situations where you're able to restructure without the need to file a Chapter 12. But each situation is unique. I don't think Ken, you and I have done a Chapter 12 that the two of them are alike. They're all going to be different. Okay?
Well, thank you for those comments. That really helps to kind of clarify things, I think. There's also another question now come wondering about the differences with bankruptcy laws. I mean, presume most of the things you gentlemen have talked about this morning are particularly regarding the federal law, but are there also state-specific laws that govern some aspects of bankruptcy within particular states?
This is Ken, and the bankruptcy is totally a federal legal proceeding. So if you file a Chapter 12 in Colorado, it's filed in Denver. You don't file in your county or your local district court. It's a federal proceeding. The vast majority of the bankruptcy laws are contained in the Bankruptcy Code, which is a federal code. There's just
very little state law that figures in to the bankruptcy code. Now, having said that, there are sometimes, once in a while, we'll have a situation where the bankruptcy judge will look at state law for guidance in making a decision. But the bankruptcy code is a federal law.
Okay, that helps quite a bit. Another question is kind of along the line of the big picture again. There's certainly risk associated with most of the decisions made by managers involved in commercial agriculture. I'm wondering, what are some of the risks that are involved in the decision to use bankruptcy to resolve a current set of financial problems? Or maybe another way to put it is, what are some of the consequences or some of the things that a manager ought to be looking for with bankruptcy versus, you know, say some other alternative action that they might take?
I would say that the many of the people that we work with have tried all of the other alternatives, and they're down to the decision of, do I file bankruptcy under Chapter 12 and try and reorganize, or do I just turn everything back over to the bank? I mean, that a lot of times it comes down to that. So those are your two choices. Now, that's assuming that you've tried to mediate and be proactive and work with your creditors. The disadvantages of filing the Chapter 12, the possible disadvantages would be, first of all, if your plan is not confirmed, then you've spent some money and some time and some energy trying to do something, and it didn't work. That would be one disadvantage. The second disadvantage is that it obviously, if you file any type of a bankruptcy or if you're involved in a foreclosure or any legal proceeding, it's going to be a negative mark on your credit report. So those, I think, are the two disadvantages of filing the Chapter 12. But again, most people don't file it unless they just have no other alternative other than to just liquidate.
Okay. Another member of our audience has asked if you have any particular perspective on bankruptcy, sort of thinking from the lender standpoint. Are there some insights that you might share, thinking or coming at it from that perspective as to the ins and outs of bankruptcy?
The lenders, and this, of course, just as a general rule, the lenders, obviously, they don't like the bankruptcy, because when the bank examiners come and see that one of their customers has filed bankruptcy, it causes problems for the bank with the bank examiners to some extent. In other words, the loans may have to be reclassified and devalued, and there's negative consequences for the lender there. The lenders sometimes are cooperative in the Chapter 12 cases, and by cooperative I mean they'll try and negotiate out an agreement. In some cases, the lenders just to kind of take a no prisoners approach, and their attitude is that we don't think this reorganization is going to work. So it varies a lot from lender to lender and from case to case.
If I can just add a comment, in a personal experience, not working with Ken but with another attorney related to Chapter 12. There was an extremely bad relationship, personal relationship, between the creditor and the debtor. And the legal fees that were charged in that case were phenomenal relative to even the level of debt that was in existence. So that's sort of an impetus, for my opinion, for farmers to make sure that they maintain a really good relationship with their lenders, so we don't get into these contests where personalities start to play a role. So that can get very costly. Now, you're not maybe one out of 1,000 you're going to run into those deals, but that can create some real problems trying to get a Chapter 12 approved.
Yeah, it certainly creates challenges that a person would prefer to avoid. So thank you for those comments. Another question's come in here. Person's wondering about most farms who are eligible for Chapter 12 will likely have debt that's both personal debt and debt of the farm itself, especially with the prevalence of credit card financing that a lot of people are using for both business and personal financing in current times. So they're wondering, how is it that these two sources of debt are going to be handled by the court in workouts for a farm family situation?
This is Ken, and I would say, first of all, that I'm assuming that this person or this family is eligible for Chapter 12. But if you're eligible for Chapter 12, the personal debts and the farm debts are addressed in the same proceeding. They're addressed in the same reorganization plan. And so if you have, let's say that the wife is a school teacher in town and she's buying a Honda on payments, those Honda payments on her car, even though it's not related to the agricultural part of the business, the payments on that car are addressed in the Chapter 12 plan, right along with the farm and ranch obligations.
Okay, I've had another member of our audience ask a question about the overall bill for legal fees. Does that usually relate to the size of the bankruptcy itself and the total settlement, or is it charged out on a billable hour basis for the attorneys that are involved?
It's billed out on an hourly basis. Normally, the normal procedure is that the attorney and the client agree on a retainer that needs to be paid before the case is filed. There's a lot of the legal work that needs to be done in these cases is done prior to filing. There's a lot of schedules and forms and motions and paperwork that needs to be prepared before the case is even filed. So a retainer is paid. The amount of the retainer is negotiated or discussed with the attorney and the client, and that retainer is then put into a trust account. As the attorney does work on the case, he pulls money out of the trust account. Now, usually these attorney fees have to be approved by the Chapter 12 judge. So the attorney submits his bill that shows what work he did and how much time he spent on that work to the judge, and then the judge will either approve or disapprove those legal fees. And then once they're approved, that money will come out of that retainer to pay the attorney fees. So that's how that's done. Now, if the retainer, if the money in the retainer runs out during the case, then that presents a situation where either another retainer needs to be paid or payments need to be set up for the attorney as part of the Chapter 12 plan. But hourly rate attorney fees is the primary way that attorneys are compensated.
And likewise, the farm management expert would also have to be approved by the court.
Yeah.
And his fees, and usually his fees are not paid until after the 12 is approved, or unless it's converted to a 7, then he results in the unsecured pile like the rest of us. So both cases has to be approved by the court.
Yeah, and keep in mind that anyone that you hire in a Chapter 12 case has to be approved by the bankruptcy judge. So if you want to hire someone like Norm, a farm and ranch consultant, and Norm obviously has been approved in many cases, and he's well respected. But if you, on the other hand, if you're going to hire, somebody from your local community that's never stepped foot into the bankruptcy arena, there may be objections to his employment. You know, it may be harder to get that person approved because he doesn't have the experience. He or she doesn't have the experience to do that work. And it's this, you know, the attorney has to be approved. The farm consultant has to be approved. The appraiser, if you have an appraisal done during the case, that person needs to be approved. If you hire a CPA, which sometimes is necessary, that person needs to be approved by the court.
Well, thank you for that explanation. That helps clear up some of how the behind-the-scenes stuff works. Here's another detailed question someone sent in, is wondering how the terms of the debt repayment are actually determined, both the term and interest rate, as they are set by the court. How has that worked out?
Well, in most cases, it's been my experience, if we're talking about real estate debt, we're probably talking, the 20-year M period. And certainly, as Ken mentioned earlier, the market rate for interest would be the appropriate interest rate to apply. You're not going to get much of a break on interest rates from the bankruptcy court, because most of the judges are well aware of what market rates are. I have seen some situations to help cash flows on reorganization plans where possibly on livestock or machinery notes, where the bank has agreed to maybe am it over a longer period of time. For example, one case I worked on machinery, the bank agreed to am the note over over 7 years with a balloon in 5 years, which gave them a little bit of a break in terms of their payments on an annual basis on that. I've seen it as high as 10 years with a balloon in 7. But I would caution people that at the end of 7 years or 5 years, whenever that balloon payment comes due and payable, can create some real financial problems. And we saw that in the 80s, where a lot of people were buying homes with really high interest rates with balloon payments in 10 years or 15 years, and ended up consequently losing those properties because basically at that point in time, the note becomes due and payable unless you have identified a new lender that to refinance it, or the existing lender has agreed to refinance it. It can create some problems, but nevertheless, it does provide some ease in terms of maybe possibly reducing your payments on whatever period of time you're amortizing it over. At least reduces the amount of payment on an annual basis, hopefully.
Okay, here's kind of a follow-up on that in some ways. Person's wondering if they're having to make a choice or look at the trade-off between the loan value itself and more affordable terms as the workout's being put together, how should the capital gains tax considerations play into that decision? I mean, how should a person look at the capital gains taxes and the implication that it may have both for the loan value and then the terms of the loan itself?
Well, I think you'd have to, of course, the capital gains tax considerations would only apply in where you actually are selling assets during the Chapter 12. But if that's the case, then you know that would be something you'd do on a case-by-case basis. You just have to look at the specific numbers for that situation. And, you know, that's normally going to mean you're going to need to get with your accountant, find out what the basis is in the assets, do the tax, the math on the tax part of it, and then look at that versus what the alternatives are. I don't think you can make a generalization about that. I think it just, every case is going to be different.
If I can just expand on it, I think there's some other options under the the title in lieu of foreclosure kind of things, where the seller actually might be faced with some significant capital gains tax, where he turns the title over or she turns the title over in lieu of foreclosure proceedings. Whereas the 12 provides you with some a little bit different tax treatment, which could protect you in terms of your capital gains tax that may be facing your business. So those are things that you need to discuss with either your farm consultant or with your farm accountant or whoever you're working with prior to, and the attorney, obviously, before you file a Chapter 12 or a Chapter 11, what those consequences might be.
Okay. And Norm, I think you touched on this earlier. I mean, you just now mentioned it again about the importance of that outside expert or farm management person that a person facing reorganization or bankruptcy likely needs to get in onto their team. Have you or either one of you have any recommendations on how a person would go about contacting someone in their state for assistance in that area, either if they have to provide testimony or just provide backstop or assistance in putting the figures together as part of the workout plan?
Well, you know, there's a number of considerations, I think, aside from the qualifications, but in some states, for example, I'll be very honest about my position here. I'm a full professor, so I'm allowed to do some consulting one day a week. So I can do this on a consulting basis. If I were 100% extension, I would not be able to do that. Not that I get paid for all of the Chapter 12s I've done. But finding an expert can be kind of difficult, primarily because people are really nervous about going in a courtroom and testifying and being qualified, because in many cases it's not the most rewarding experience you want to go through. But I've always been of the opinion, I grew up on a ranch in North Dakota, and I feel like it's my obligation to help as many farmers and ranchers as I can in the state of Colorado. I've also worked in Wyoming and Nebraska and helping farmers as well. But certainly the first place I would start is with a land grant institution and a person such as yourself, John, who is a farm management specialist. Possibly those individuals would have some people that they would recommend the farmer, rancher, or dairy person, whatever, get in touch with.
Okay. Well, thank you for that suggestion. There's another question that's come in here. I was wondering whether, in your guys' opinion, if the limited capacity of the courts at present to process a bankruptcy proceedings is currently putting any kind of pressure on creditors to settle with their debtors outside of the bankruptcy courtroom.
Well, I would say that the answer to that is probably yes. And it's been that way for a long time. The bankruptcy judges are very busy, and as I said earlier, they will often suggest strongly that all the attorneys get together and try to hammer out a negotiated agreement on each loan. This is something that's just, it's almost, the judges, it's almost to the point where they don't even need to say that because everyone understands it. It's a win-win if you can go into the judge at the final confirmation hearing and say, "Judge, we've ironed out our differences, we've reached agreements with all the different creditors, we've got a what we call a consensual plan," which means everyone has consented to it. I think there is pressure on all the different players to try and negotiate out an agreement. Now, does that mean that in every case it works that way? No. So we've had cases where we were able to negotiate, say, with John Deere on their payments. We were able to negotiate with the local operating lender. We were able to negotiate with most of the creditors. But we have one or two creditors that just, you know, they just will not, we cannot reach an agreement with them. And in those cases, then we do have to have a confirmation hearing. And the judge, the judges usually are appreciative that you've made as much progress as you have. In other words, you're just not throwing the whole thing in his lap. But in some cases, you do go to the judge and say, "Judge, we just can't work this out with this one particular lender. And so we need to have a hearing just to address this lender's disputes." And so that's, that does come up sometimes.
Right. And you have to, the audience has to realize that these federal bankruptcy judges are dealing with, not just 12s, but 7s, 11s, and 13s as well. So I remember very distinctly in Denver, when they filed the new version of the, you know, made Chapter 12 a permanent chapter in the bankruptcy code, and they had revisited Chapter 7 and Chapter 13 and had made some changes. The last month in October of 06, I think there was something like 70,000 Chapter 7s and 13s filed in the district court, or the federal district court in Denver. So they are very busy, the judges. One other comment that I think probably is appropriate is that the trustee, the bankruptcy trustee, can also file objections. So you all, you know, in addition to working through the bankruptcy with the various creditors, also the trustee has to approve the plan as well, because he's the one that's going to be dispersing the funds. So that's another little aspect to consider.
Okay, well, thank you both for taking so many questions. I think we've pretty well worked through them all now, and appreciate very much your well-reasoned and thought-out answers. It's explained a number of things for me, and I'm sure has helped clarify a number of points for the audience as well. I really want to thank you both again for taking the time to be with us today. I'm confident that many of our participants have actually gained a number of insights from your wealth of experience and participation in bankruptcies over so many years. As we move to wrap up today's program, I'd like to remind everyone about the recordings of both the audio MP3 files and the video downloads of our previous programs that are available on our website. We invite you to consider participating in one or more of our upcoming webinars that you can see scheduled on the website there at Ag in Uncertain Times. As mentioned earlier, the recordings and other information are available on this website, and we will provide some additional instructions here at the end in just a second, how to get to that site and how to access the material. If you're interested in today's presentation slides, they are also available at that site for download and your later reading. We'd like to particularly encourage you to consider sitting in on tomorrow's presentation by Ruth Hambleton and Dr. Bob Fetch, who will be offering additional tools and materials for, again, helping farm families facing these difficult times we're in today. Coming up in November, we'll be hosting a number of presenters with tools and techniques for operating in risky environments, beginning on the 4th of November. It might be worth noting that all of our webinars are actually slated to begin at the same time, which is 9 Pacific, 10 Mountain, 11 Central, and 12 noon Eastern. We should also mention that we'd like to hear from you if you have suggestions for other topics or presentations that you would like to see offered in the future. You can either get that to us by making your suggestion through the chat pod there on the screen, or by sending an email to westrme@wsu.edu. As we've mentioned as we've gone along today, that a number of different URLs and websites may be of interest to you to pursue. And in order to provide you with a single reference for all of those pieces of information, we've compiled a PDF file, which you may now download via this file share pod I've just put up on the screen. To do that, you click on the file name you see listed there in the pod, and then click on the Save to My Computer button at the bottom to download that file to your own desktop. So let me just close by again extending our thanks to both of today's presenters for their first-class presentation on bankruptcy, and thanks also to our Ag and Uncertain Times team and their sponsoring institutions for making this series possible. We'd also very much like to thank all the participants in today's webinar. We sincerely hope that you find today's content of value in your work with farm families, and we hope to see you again on one of our upcoming programs. Until then, we offer you our sincerest hope for success in meeting the challenges of today's uncertain times. For Ag in Uncertain Times, I'm John Hewlett.